The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Like that warm, fuzzy feeling you get after a snowball fight during a nuclear winter, you are now Skeptically Speaking, the science call-in talk show that asks you to call in and question everything. Skeptically Speaking starts right now, so let's get started.
Thanks, Sean.
Hello, everyone. We have an important show for you today. We'll be talking about nuclear power. We tried this topic once before at the height of our technical difficulty period. You may remember that, not fondly. And so we're revisiting the topic. There will be no speaking up or brownie in motion today, as we definitely do need the full hour to speak with our guests. So, with us in studio is Dr. Jeremy Whitlock, reactor physicist and manager of non-proliferation and safeguards at the Atomic Energy of Canada Limited's Chalk River Laboratories. He has a PhD in engineering physics from McMaster University, with a specialty in CANDU reactor physics. He is also a fellow of the Canadian Nuclear Society, as well as past president and a member of their board of directors. Dr. Whitlock is a public speaker and author on nuclear issues, and he created the website, The Canadian Nuclear FAQ. So also with us is Elena Schauherl, founder and co-chair of Citizens Advocating the Use of Sustainable Energy, also known as CAUSE, which is a member of the Coalition for a Nuclear-Free Alberta. In addition to her involvement in the nuclear issue in Alberta, in the 90s, she was actually on the steering committee of Pokebusters, which was an anti-nuclear group from Saskatoon who stopped the development of the slowpoke reactor that was proposed for the university campus there. And actually, the University of Alberta has one. She is also the co-author of the alternative report on nuclear power, which was a response to the Alberta government's nuclear panel report that they issued a few months ago. So thanks very much, both of you, for being here.
Thank you.
A pleasure to see you in person, Desiree.
Thank you. You as well. We would also, of course, love to hear from the audience. We are taking calls at 780-492-2577 extension 1. Or you can email live at skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet Skeptical Radio. So first off, actually, Elena, can you just tell us a bit about CAUSE?
Well, CAUSE was formed about 2.5 years ago now when there were large headlines about nuclear coming to Alberta and dead silence from the Albertans. So given my background and the fact that I knew a little bit about the risks and dangers of nuclear, I formed a group at that time. And we're twofold. One, we have a vision of how renewable energy and energy efficiency are totally adequate in meeting the future electricity needs of Alberta, but are also opposed to the proposal to develop these first-of-their-kind nuclear plants in the Peace River region.
Okay, so what are the main things that you're doing right now? Are you lobbying?
We've just held a nuclear forum. The Alberta government is going through a consultation process that's very one-sided, very biased, and no public hearings. And so our group actually called in a few speakers and held a public forum in Calgary about a week ago.
Wonderful. So great. Thank you. So, Jeremy? Tell us about Chalk River Labs. What do they do exactly?
Well, they do. What don't they do? Chalk River Labs is the oldest nuclear laboratory in Canada. It's the flagship laboratory. It's owned by the people of Canada. It belongs to Atomic Energy of Canada Limited, which is a crown corporation, created in the mid-40s to pursue nuclear energy and all aspects of that. From that came the CANDU reactor in the 60s. Nuclear medicine got started almost right away. The first cobalt cancer therapy was in 1951. And actually just next door in Saskatchewan was one of the first ones that used cobalt-60 manufactured at Chalk River Laboratories using some of the expertise there. And also there's basic science going on. A lot of the basic knowledge of matter was explored in Canada at Chalk River Laboratories. Today, it largely serves as an engineering support laboratory for CANDU reactors. So the concept was born there and continues to be supported in an R&D role.
Okay, so they don't actually make the reactors?
No, no, they don't. They do the fundamental science and engineering behind the components, the fuel, the physics, the plumbing.
Speaking of physics, can you tell us, I don't know how briefly you can tell us, but how does nuclear power work? I can't say that in any simpler way.
Okay, well, the easiest way I can explain it is perhaps to explain how a coal station works, because it works almost exactly the same way. If you go to a coal station in Alberta and look at it, you see a heat source, and it's the heat source that's different between the two systems. But it's a heat source that's boiling water and making steam. And the steam is used in what's basically a steam engine to turn the turbine, which turns a generator, which makes electricity. So whether you're burning oil or gas or coal or uranium, it's heat. And it's where the heat comes from that makes the difference. The other end of things is the type of waste and where the waste goes. If it's a coal plant, the waste management can be seen visibly from the outside. It's a chimney next to the station, and a lot of the waste goes up the chimney or is segregated as a solid waste sludge. And for nuclear, this is all the waste is kept in the same form as the fuel itself at the plant itself. The heat, on the other hand, going in at the front, is nuclear fission. And this is something that was discovered just before World War II started in 1939, and it's the fact that you can split the uranium atom and get a whole bunch of energy. And by whole bunch, I mean millions of times more than any sort of chemical reaction. So the burning of anything, the oxidization of anything, is millions of times less energetic than any nuclear reaction, such as the splitting of uranium. And they discovered not only can you extract a whole bunch of energy this way, but it propagates itself. You hit a uranium atom with a neutron, which is a subatomic particle, of which there are many in the uranium nucleus. It splits in half, gives off all this energy, and two or three more neutrons are emitted. And they said, wow, not only a whole bunch of energy, but the same thing we threw at it in the first place is now coming off the other end, and not just one of them, but two or three of them. So we can use that to do the same thing over again, and this is the chain reaction. It's a self-propagating chain reaction. The rest of it is the engineering to do that in a safe and economic manner, which is what we have today in the CANDU reactor. Does that explain it?
Mostly.
Mostly.
But,
okay.
Actually, what I'm wondering is, speaking of reactors, there's a lot of talk about the generations of reactors.
Right.
So maybe if you could give us a little bit of a history lesson, what was the generation one and where are we now?
Yeah, you hear talk about, we're at the generation three. We're Gen 3. So all you Gen X's and Gen Y's out there, we're in the Gen 3. Gen 1 was the first reactors that came out just after the war. So these are like the prototypes, the prototype reactors. And Canada had sort of a version of these generation reactors all along the way. The Gen 2 were the first commercial power reactors that we have. We have the Douglas Point reactor in Ontario was like that. And the early Pickering reactors. The Gen 3s are the versions we have now, which have advanced safety features. We also talk about Gen 3 Plus, which have more passive safety features. Gen 4 is what we talk about coming online in about 2030. And these are reactors that have enhanced proliferation resistance, safety, economics, and fuel cycles. They can use different types of fuel. CANDU is both types of CANDU reactors that we are marketing from our storefront right now, if you will, is the CANDU 6, or the enhanced CANDU 6, as we call it. And that's the type that's, if you go to New Brunswick, that's the type that's there near St. John. The enhanced CANDU 6 is based on the design that we've sold internationally around the world, and also in Quebec and New Brunswick. And then there's the advanced CANDU reactor, which is the one that Elena referred to earlier. It's not a first of a kind. I would say it's about 80% this the same as the CANDU 6. It's sort of like the new model on the showroom floor kind of thing. So it's very much similar. It has certain advancements. It uses light water coolant instead of heavy water coolant, and what that means is another story in itself. But basically, the upshot is to have a reactor that can get more power from a smaller footprint, basically. So it's sort of an evolution from the CANDU 6. So these are the different generations. We're currently in Gen 3.
Perfect. Thank you. So this is a big issue for Alberta right now. Nuclear development has been proposed, potentially 4 reactors, from what I read. And the provincial government issued a report that I mentioned earlier on the issues associated with generating nuclear power. So according to CAUSE's press release, the report was, in quotes, nuclear propaganda that misleads the public and ignores all the drawbacks. Elena, can you talk about what was in the government's report?
Well, first of all, it was put together by a nuclear panel that included a member of the board of Atomic Energy of Canada Limited, whereas this panel said they weren't taking any input from proponents or opponents to nuclear, but they had someone from the organization that wants to sell the reactors sitting right on the panel. Then they went ahead and they hired Idaho National Laboratories, which is one of the biggest producers of nuclear in the United States, and Alberta Research Council to write the report. But before they did that, they actually had signed a memorandum of understanding between the two organizations in which they're going to benefit from considerable research on the byproducts of the reactors proposed for the Peace River region in Alberta. So that put the people preparing the report in a position that they were going to benefit financially from a big research project if they wrote a report that was a bit slanted. And if you've had a chance to look at the report and the consultation document, I would say that this has been more about trying to convince Albertans rather than consult Albertans, and doing so unsuccessfully. The report was supposed to be unbiased, it was supposed to be balanced, but what they've done is they virtually eliminated the many risks of nuclear, including cost risks, health risks, the impact on the environment. That's not in the report.
And so CAUSE wrote their own alternative report.
We wrote it at the same time, knowing that, number one, there was a member from Atomic Energy of Canada Limited on this panel, and number two, they refused to listen to Dr. Helen Caldicott, who's a pediatrician and has international reputation and her knowledge of nuclear. We rather expected a one-sided report. So what we did was spend several months, myself and Heinz-Jürgen Peter, he's a nuclear physicist, that's his training. He lives here in St. Albert, and the two of us, with others involved in the research, put together, took the same mandate that the panel was given, looking at the risks, the waste, all the same issues, and went through and did our research and our perspective on it.
I did read both reports. They are significantly different.
Yes.
Your report mentions that when nuclear power is compared to renewable technologies such as wind and solar power, the benefits of investing scarce resources in clean electricity capacity will offer higher long-term returns than making future investments in coal and nuclear. Can you explain that? Can you talk about that?
Well, first of all, there's always a lot of talk about the jobs to come from this nuclear development, but in actual fact, there are 2 to 5 times as many jobs from renewable energy and from energy efficiency. And that information is not only in Pembina Institute's Greening the Grid that provides a wonderful vision of how this can all happen, but even the Canadian Labour Congress has taken that position, that there are simply more jobs. Also, nuclear has, including the CANDU here in Canada, such a terrible track record in terms of the costs. Even the Fraser Institute in their Fraser Forum, March of 2008, expressed concern about taking the liability to the taxpayer by taking the risk of building first of their kind reactors. And I know Jeremy said they're not first of their kind, but in fact they're a hybrid. They're part pressurized heavy water, they're part light water, and they use enriched uranium instead of natural uranium. And in fact, I don't know where they're at in terms of the design, which had not been completed, but they were having difficulty achieving a negative void coefficiency, which means during a loss of coolant accident, which is the kind of accident that can lead to a core meltdown, the reactor actually powers up instead of powering down. So that's a serious problem. They didn't get that to work when they took it to they took the smaller ACR 1000 down to the nuclear regulatory body in the United States, and it wasn't working then. So maybe Jeremy can tell us where it's at, but that was a problem.
Jeremy, did you want to respond?
Okay, I can start with that one. The one for the States, it was never intended to have a negative void. It was to have a low void coefficient. And once we get into that, we're getting into some pretty archaic areas of reactor physics. As Elena was saying, it's the response of the reactor to loss of coolant or if the density to a decrease of the coolant. Current Candu reactors have a positive void coefficient. This is actually one of the safety advantages of the reactor. It isn't necessarily a safety disadvantage, and it would be if it was in a light water reactor, if it had a positive void coefficient. That's why they have to make sure those reactors don't. In a heavy water reactor, the response of the reactor to any change in reactivity is a few orders of magnitude slower than any light water reactor. And this means when you increase the reactivity of the core, it goes into a phase that we call prompt critical, which like it sounds, is prompt. Things are moving rather quickly. If that happens in a light water reactor, where most of literature can be found, if you were to do a Google, you would find bad things said about it, because if that happens, the reactor is written off. So you avoid that stage or that configuration at all costs. And in a Candu reactor, that's just part of the normal design safety envelope, and you have a safety system which the response of the reactor is slow enough in this prompt criticality stage that you can design engineering systems, we can shut the reactor down. And we have a couple of them, fast-acting shutdown systems that work. So positive void coefficient is not an issue. It's a feature of the reactor. And it makes the reactor more safe, because now you have a immediate fast-acting signal. The neutrons start multiplying to any sort of loss of coolant in any of the coolant tubes, where in any other reactor you have to depend on something heating up downstream or pressure rising or temperature. So there's various reasons why it's not a big issue. In a Candu, you can make the reactor any void coefficient you want by changing the fuel. The ACR, it's simple, is just a case of changing the enrichment of the fuel or some other parameter, so that's not an issue at all. If I can just address a couple of the other points, there was the question of jobs in the renewable sector. I don't like to compare renewable energy to nuclear, because they don't really compete. When we're talking about solar power and wind power, we're talking about opportunity power. The energy flows when the sun's shining, when the wind's blowing. When it is, you have a free fuel source. You use that to displace a dirtier fuel source, whether it's coal or even nuclear, if you're going to save on using nuclear fuel. But you don't have a reliability there. And utilities that actually use large amounts of wind power, like in Germany, where they have one utility's got over 7,000 megawatts of wind power, and this is by legislation, they have to. They have in their annual report, they say how there's a certain percentage of their grid that you do not want to exceed with wind power, and it's around 10%, because anything more than that, and the reliability of the entire grid is affected. And one of the reasons is that one of the impacts of the unreliability is that for every megawatt of wind power, say, that you've got on your grid, if you are depending on it, if you're not depending on it, it's fine. Like in Ontario, we have so much generation, we can experiment with wind farms all we want. But if you're depending on it, you've got to have another source of power spinning and ready. So you're burning fuel in a coal plant to have spinning reserve up to about 80% is what the German utility says. So really, they don't compete with each other. In order to be able to have wind power and solar power, you've got to have a steady baseload power source and reliable, which lets you experiment with these other systems. Now, in terms of jobs, I've never counted the jobs.
Let's just get to jobs in one second.
Okay, sure.
The wind power and the solar power. Elena, is that something that we can realistically do right now?
Absolutely. I want to just quickly, so I don't forget it, the positive void coefficiency presented as some sort of benefit. In fact, Chernobyl, part of the accident was that reactor, which is the closest, it's obviously lots of dissimilarities, but was the closest to the CANDU reactor, the positive void coefficient was a factor in that accident. So I won't go in a lot of detail, but I'm surprised to see it touted as a benefit. In terms of renewables and the issue of base load power. So there's a couple of things here. One is that there's been great strides made in terms of wind storage and also in terms of connecting multiple wind farms onto the grid. And those are ways to increase its reliability. Also virtual power plants. So there's great leaps and strides in terms of improving the reliability. If you're looking at baseload here in the province, the really exciting potential is in geothermal, and it actually would bring transferable skills from the oil and gas industry because they've had lots of experience in drilling. So why aren't we looking at that option, which has much fewer risks and rather than repeating the mistakes that were made in Ontario with nuclear. In terms of the ACR 1000, if I understood correctly, it doesn't sound like they've got the negative void coefficient. And in fact, that problem of gearing up instead of down was a similar problem that the Maple reactor had in Chalk River, that they couldn't get it to work. In that case, it wasn't something that happened during a nuclear accident, but it happened during normal operation. But they had trouble with that design. And I think that in itself produces a bit of a lack of confidence that they're going to be able to pull the ACR 1000 off.
Okay, again, callers, the number is 780-492-2577, extension 1, or live at skepticallyspeaking.com or Skeptical Radio on Twitter. Okay, now let's talk about this situation here. We're getting a little bit into safety, and I know once the conversation goes there, we are not getting off it. So,
can I answer a few of those points?
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, first of all, the ACR 1000 does have the negative void. Maybe I didn't make that clear earlier. It has been achieved, and what I was saying was that it's quite easy to do. Chernobyl has nothing to do with the Candu reactor. They have this conceptual similarity in positive void coefficient, but I can assure you I'm an expert on positive void coefficient. It's just not similar. It's much larger. It's variable. They fixed it in the Chernobyl reactors since then, but it was a design that would just never have been built. It's like saying that their cars have four wheels, our cars have four wheels. So the ACR has a negative void coefficient, and this is pretty much which I didn't make clear. This is pretty much what certain markets demand, which is why the ACR was being marketed in the United States and not the Candu 6 reactor. Certain licensing jurisdictions demand a negative void coefficient, and that's why the ACR was marketed there. And then it has other advantages in terms of footprint, which makes it advantageous in terms of power per square kilometer and that kind of thing. They make it advantageous for Alberta. The Maple reactors in Chalk River, that's a straw man. I worked on those too, by the way, and they worked fine. I was in the control room when they ran at almost full power. Those reactors are beautiful systems that have been maligned in the press. The power coefficient was a licensing issue. It was a very small technical parameter which did not affect the safety in any practical way. What they were stopped for was the fact that it would take so long to get them commissioned because of licensing issues, which is another topic altogether. But let's not compare it to the positive void coefficient in power reactors.
Now, we do actually have a question from somebody that emailed before the show, and it's about Chalk River.
Yeah, it's five parts here, so it's almost hard to pick where to start. We can't address all of them. But maybe we'll just pick a random one here. According to Wikipedia, and that links to the article, there was a poisoning incident in 1990 at the Point Leprou nuclear generating station in New Brunswick, in which the assistant plant operator put a sample of heavy water in an office water cooler, resulting in several employees receiving elevated radiation doses from tritium and activated chemicals after drinking the contaminated water. Is this a true story? And if so, how could this have happened? And apparently all of the rest of the five are about Chalk River, and that one isn't. I just picked a random number.
So we can deal with that one first.
Yeah.
Yes, that happened. The man was charged and went to jail. He got a hold of some heavy water, and he thought it would be a joke to put it in the water cooler. Whether or not he'd realized it was contaminated, I'm not sure, but people work at the plant and have access to different things, and you could have hit somebody over the head with a crowbar as well, but he decided to put heavy water into a cooler. There was a contamination. The tritium, which was in the heavy water, I mean, tritium is one of nature's least radioactive materials. It is something that is created in Candu reactors, which is where this person probably got it from. It also gets maligned in the press. Of all the radionuclides that Health Canada regulates, and set by saying how much of this you can have in per liter of drinking water, say the drinking water standard. If you go on the Health Canada website, which is echoed on the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission website, they list all the radionuclides and they give the number of becquerels, which is the number of disintegrations per second, which is related to the amount that you can have per liter. And for tritium, it's 7,000 becquerels per liter, which is, and the other amounts that you would see for other radionuclides are in the range of 10 or 5 or okay. sometimes up to 100. So 7,000 is a large number, which people say, oh my goodness, that's huge. That's massive. How can they allow that? It's the same, it's the same basis that the other ones use, and the number is large because the biological effect is much less. And that's the end of the story. There's no other reason for it.
Do we have a caller?
We do, yes. Let's get Nathan on the line here. How are you there, Nathan?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Go ahead. I've got a question for Elena. I'm still not quite understanding how wind power can match the sheer magnitude of power that is capable of being generated by a nuclear reaction. I was wondering if you might be able to explain that.
Okay, so it's not just wind. If I encourage you to go to Pembina Institute Screening the Grid for all the details, but energy efficiency, it's part of a package that would see wind, micropower, energy efficiency, cogeneration as a transition, and geothermal eventually to start to phase out coal. So it's not, we're not looking at only wind, but the reliability is improving with some of the different methods that are being developed.
Well, I've looked into it, and I see even solar power is still nowhere near capable of supporting even a house.
It
can certainly help offset some of the cost, but I don't see where it's capable of taking over the whole grid.
Well, solar power, I don't know if you know, but NMAX has got a program in place that's coming being implemented next year, where they're going to actually rent solar photovoltaics to homeowners. And in Germany, in a period of just 4 years, they actually put solar panels on 100,000 homes. And that country now, in a very short period of time, has 20,000 megawatts of power from renewable energy. So it certainly can be done, and we can look to places such as Germany to see how it has been done.
Did that answer your question, Nathan?
Well, sort of, but we'll turn this one back to Jeremy. Thanks.
Thanks very much for calling. And just on sort of a similar note, speaking of solar, everyone should Google the Eco Home Solar Tour that's going on tomorrow. I'll be attending. There's a whole bunch of places around the River Valley that that are going to have their open houses. It's solar retrofits and places that have been built to spec, and it should be interesting. All right, Jeremy, did you want to respond to that one?
Well, I was going to say that I want to make it clear that nobody I know in the nuclear business is advocating the end of wind or solar or any other renewable. In fact, I point out to people that about a month or so ago, maybe it was longer because there was snow on the ground, I had the pleasure to go to a colleague's house near Deep River, Ontario, where he was trying to get himself off-grid. This is a fellow who works at Chalk River, and he was just having an open house on a Saturday afternoon to show some of his friends how he heats his house. He has a solar panel out the back, and he's got the floors heated and all this kind of thing. This is active solar heating. Lives on a farm out in the rural area near Deep River. And I went there, and the place was stacked. And at one point, I'm standing in this room, and he's holding forth. He could be in a nuclear conference explaining something, but no, he's explaining how his heat pump works. And I looked around the room, and I thought, my gosh, this room is, that guy's thermal hydrologist, that guy's a nuclear physicist. I'm looking around the room, and then all these people I know who work in the nuclear industry, and I thought, I bet there's not one person outside this area that wouldn't be surprised to see that these people are, and we were not there to make fun of this fellow. We're there because we were interested in technology. He had some really cool technology. And if I was living outside, in a rural area outside Deep River, I might be looking into that too if I had a lot of spare time on my hands, which I don't. But I do not advocate that kind of energy usage for heating condominiums in downtown Toronto or factories or aluminum smelters. So there's a lot of electricity out there that's needed. It's a lot of electricity. And I don't think people appreciate how much electricity is out there. Homes are just the tip of the iceberg. Homes are 20%, 25% of the electricity usage. Maybe there's a lot less industrial electricity use now with the economy, but it's going to pick back up again. So I think all of these other technologies are great, and I always when I'm driving down to Toronto from my home, and I always bother my family by taking them through this area north of Toronto where there's a wind farm, and we always drive through it. They say, "Oh no, Dad, not again." And I think the technology is just neat.
And wind farms are beautiful.
And wind farm, I wouldn't want to live near one. I'm a NIMBY with a wind farm, but anyway, for other reasons. But I think as a technology, they're great. But I'm not disillusioned to think that it's actually solving the problem. It's part of the mix, and a major part of the mix has to be baseload reliable power from nuclear.
All right, and on that note, we're going to go to a commercial, and we'll be right back to talk about this more. Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call in every Friday from 6 to 7 p.m. Mountain Standard Time at 780-492-2577 extension 1. That's 780-492-2577 extension 1. You can also email your questions and comments before or during the show to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, we're at Skeptical Radio. After the show, continue the conversation on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com or check out our Facebook group. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Skeptically Speaking is also rebroadcast on Public Reality Radio, WPRR 1680 AM in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Citywide LP 99.1 FM in Madison, Wisconsin, and on freethoughtradio.com. And now, back to the show.
And we're back, everybody. We're going to go to one of the Chalk River questions, that I had said we would get to and misread my email queue. So the question is, what are the most serious nuclear reactor problems that you've had at Chalk River since the 1952 NRX accident and the 1958 NRU accident?
What is the most serious since those two?
Okay. Yes.
Okay, I would have started.
If any, yeah.
Well, Chalk River is an aging facility, and I don't think that has to be, people have to be reminded of that, because you just have to look on in the front page of the papers every other day, and it says that. It was built during the 40s, so it does have lots of issues. It has leakage from the spent fuel bays from the NRX reactor, which is one of our shutdown reactors. And by leakage, I mean you can see a plume of water on the property making its way towards the Ottawa River. And this is mitigated. I mean, it's a slow enough movement that you can mitigate it. There's obviously the problems with the NRU reactor, the National Research Universal Reactor, which was built in 1957. It itself had a fire in 1958, but it's been operating ever since. Its main problem is that it's old, and it's like an old car, and it's like its radiator system is leaking. Often you hear the word leak, and when an engineer hears leak, they just think of the system itself has stuff coming out. We don't necessarily think of that it's going into the environment. The problem is when the public hears leak, they think it's going into the environment. So I wish they would come up with a new word. The reactor is leaking, but everything that's coming out, about 5 kilograms an hour is the estimate of heavy water, is being collected and is being dealt with, and it's just kept in a special management location. The leak itself, this is what's keeping the NRU reactor down right now, is being investigated. They figure it'll be down for many months, and it's in the vessel itself, which holds the heavy water. When they determine the extent of the holes, how big they are, at the bottom of the vessel, so you can appreciate this, it's a very big reactor. It's about 20 feet in diameter and 20 feet deep, and full of nuclear fuel. They will fix it and get the reactor going. That's the plan. It does produce most of the world's radioisotopes now, so that market is waiting.
So how dangerous is that?
It's not dangerous outside the plant. I mean, it's, if you look, I understand there's pictures now on the internet of people working on the reactor, which happened since I left Ontario. So that's neat. They're showing pictures of the workers there. So obviously it's a radioactive environment when they're working on the reactor itself. They've got the lid partially open and they're in there with long handled tools. We know how to do that. That's controlling contamination is part of the job there. Nothing's coming off the site though. It's all contained. So there's no danger to the public. There are small releases of tritium because tritium is hydrogen, and tritium goes up into the air. And so there's small puffs of tritium that go up the ventilation system of the NRU, but these are way below the regulation limits for tritium. As I mentioned, tritium is not the most dangerous carcinogen out there. And these releases are well below the regulated limits on these releases.
I believe Elena had a comment about this.
Yes, this 7,000 becquerel limit here in Canada is actually 10 times what it is in the United States. It's 500 times what it is in California and 70 times the European Union. And that's because of the kind of reactor we have here with the heavy water that lets off more tritium. In fact, there was a recent study in 15 countries.
It's not because we release tritium. I told you where it came from. It's derived by the same limit that all the other radionuclides are derived. There's no difference.
It's a much higher than in any other country.
No.
Well, that is correct. The limits on how much tritium can be let into the environment in California is 500 times less.
No, Elena, with due respect, you listed three or four that it is greater than. You missed the World Health Organization, which is 10,000 becquerels per liter. You missed Australia, which is 80,000. You missed Sweden, which is 70,000. So it's actually in the middle of the world ranges. It doesn't matter because even the highest of these that we've listed in the last little while, these countries, is still way below what's dangerous. We're talking hundreds of times less than what's dangerous. So it's like saying, why is the age of drinking different in Alberta than it is in Ontario? Why is the age of driving different in the United States? Why is it 21?
Actually, there was a recent study by the International Atomic Energy Agency of 15 countries, and it was a study on exposure of nuclear workers and the effects on health. And when they looked at Canada, the percentage of cancers and leukemia that were coming from the radiation dose was much higher. And I know Dr. Rosalie Bertel has speculated that that is because of the high tritium, that is the higher tritium levels that are released by the CANDU reactors.
No, this isn't true. If you look at the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission website, they look at the studies of leukemia clusters around nuclear plants. When they discovered leukemia clusters in England in the mid-80s, every country in the world went and looked around their nuclear stations. Canada was no exception. They looked around Chalk River. They looked around all the sites. They found no link of excess cancer to the sites themselves. If anything, they found an increase or a decrease of cancer, which is not, I mean, we're not saying that's due to the radiation. That's due to other effects. For instance, around Chalk River, it's because of the well-paying jobs. And there's definitely a healthy worker effect that you see in the isolated locations like that.
Explain the healthy worker effect.
Oh, if you have a population that is well paid, gets a good salary, and has a good health plan for their family, then you're going to have more visits to the doctors, more drugs purchased, and more care generally taken. And often,
which is counterintuitive.
Often there's a correlation with less smoking and drinking. And I mean, at Deep River, we ski and canoe, and we live outdoors and have a good time in nature as well. So it's just healthy living. It has nothing to do with the reactor there.
So you're not familiar with this International Agency for Research on Cancer study? Because that's a fairly new study. I'd be happy to send it to you.
I am not familiar with the finding that there is an increase in leukemia around nuclear sites attributed to the radiation from these sites.
This was of the workers. Speaking about cancers around sites, there is a very reputable German study that was released less than a year ago. And this was commissioned by the German government. It was carried out by the University of Mainz. And they looked at 16 nuclear reactors in the country over a period of over 20 years. They looked at children under 5. And the results they found that within 5 kilometers, the excessive cancers that they found were 60% more, and the leukemia was 120% more. And they studied different distances, and there was still over what they would expect up to 70 kilometers from the reactor. And this was a very credible study. So there is definitely concerns about exposure to radiation from reactors. And I would think...
Did those studies attribute those increases in leukemia to the radiation from the plants?
That it was a very strong study, and that's what they were.
What was their conclusion? about the radiation causing those leukemias.
And Elena can answer as soon as I'm done giving the phone number again, 780-492-2577, extension 1, or live at skepticallyspeaking.com or Skeptical Radio on Twitter. And I would just like to say, audience, I'm going to ask for links from everybody to these resources and the studies that you're citing. I'd love to post those on the site. And B, I told you so. As soon as we start talking about safety, we don't talk about anything else.
So we should talk about cost.
And
we should eventually
actually,
talk about
I would
cost.
Love to talk about cost.
But let's answer my question first, please.
Yes. If you would answer that, then we can move to cost.
The difficulty is showing directly the connection, but it was such an intensive study done, with such a large number of reactors. There was a pool of 1,600 children that were studied. So it is very suggestive that this is logically where it's coming from.
No.
There was no other attributable
the
cause.
There's tons of things that can come from. The authors themselves have concluded that there is no way this can be coming from the radiation from the plants. We happen to know the radiation coming from the plants, and we happen to know the most about radiation than we know about any other agent in the environment. So we know the effects, and we know what was there. So the authors themselves concluded that there is a cluster. There's something there. These are industrial environments. It's not the radiation. It's been misinterpreted that way as it is right now.
Well, we're going to have to disagree on that one.
Sounds good.
Well, it's not us. It's the authors.
And I know that our lovely producer, Sean, is on the phone with somebody who wants to get on the air, which is lovely. Thank you very much, guys. This is a really good conversation. I appreciate it. And caller. Caller, can you hear us?
Hey, yes, I can.
Hello.
Hello.
I
just have a quick question for the panel at hand there.
Mm-hmm.
What's going to happen with the waste product that's created by these reactors? Like, what are we going to do with it? It's going to be around for a very long time. It's the kind of thing you would want to address before you make it.
There is an organization in Canada, a Nuclear Waste Management Organization, and they're working on a method of long-term storage. But that organization itself estimates that it's going to take 300 years to implement that if they can find a community to take it. Now, one thing we do know that if Alberta builds these nuclear plants, it'll now be on the short list for provinces that would be candidates for taking the nation's waste and maybe beyond that. The other thing is that same organization, the Nuclear Waste Management Organization, has themselves said that this the spent fuel from nuclear reactors are going to be a problem for hundreds of thousands of years or maybe possibly more. So that is a judgment from the experts in the country.
Jeremy, did you want to respond to that as well?
Yeah, the stuff coming out the tailpipe of my minivan is going to be a problem a lot longer than that. So the question was, what's happening to the waste? Let me just go to what immediately happens to the waste. It's the waste that's created, the spent fuel. Let's talk about the spent fuel only. It comes out of the reactor and it's stored at the site, so it does not leave the reactor site. What Ellen is referring to, of course, is the long-term plan for it. The government, in response to, there's a technology developed by Atomic Energy of Canada for long-term storage, which is emplacing it deep in the ground, essentially putting the uranium back where you got it from, not actually where you got it from, but in the same type of environment, in a place where there's no seismic activity, little or no groundwater movement, and that kind of thing, and little economic activity, little economic interest, and that defines a large fraction of northern Canada, actually. Anyway, so there's no site located or picked just yet, as Elena said. The Nuclear Waste Management Organization was formed to go coast to coast and to ask Canadians what they would want, how do they want to see this waste issue treated, including talking to scientists who said, don't call it waste. It's not waste. It's 100 times more energy still in this fuel. And so whatever you do with it, don't get it, don't put it, don't send it into the sun, and don't put it where we can't get at it, because you're depriving our future generations from having access to what may be the best source of uranium. It's just not economical to get it out to recycle it at this time, but it might when Saskatchewan dries up from its sources. So the Nuclear Waste Management Organization has this long-term plan. It's a long-term plan because that's what Canadians said. I mean, we could start tomorrow putting it in the ground. Probably the first people saying don't do it so quickly would be the scientists saying, hey, you know, hang on to it. But the Canadians said, no, new methods might come up in time. Who are we to say we know the smartest? We have idea of the best way to do with this. We're the smarter than our grandchildren. So please, whatever you do, take time. So their plan is called adaptive phased management, which is a great buzz phrase for bureaucrats, because it's much better than deep geological disposal, which was the old term that ACL had. Adaptive means we can change our ideas as we go along if better technologies come up. Phased means it's exactly what the Canadians wanted. So it starts in, it can be, you know, 60 years to emplacement. 300 years, as Ellen mentioned, is sort of the end of the thing. And in the meantime, before it gets to that, you're actually storing it in a central place. You're just not putting it in a permanent disposal. And management is better than disposal. Management is looking after it with possibly an ability to retrieve it if you want down the road. So it's in response to Canadians' requests.
Caller, did that answer? I can't speak. Did that answer your question?
Somewhat. What's going to happen? Like, okay, what's the big difference between like the uranium you start a reaction with and the uranium you end up with, and why is it still usable?
Oh, well, you start off in a let's talk about the CANDU 6 reactor, which is the kind we operate today. You start off with natural uranium, which contains less than 1% of the usable uranium, which is uranium-235. And so it's actually 0.7%. And over the course of being in the reactor, this uranium splits in half and it goes down to about 0.2 or 0.3%. At the same time, you build in something called plutonium, which also fissions and gives off energy. And so if you look at a CANDU reactor that's been operating for a while, it's got plutonium in the fuel, and actually about half the energy comes from plutonium and the other half comes from uranium. And it's also building in fission products. These roughly half pieces of uranium are building up. And when the fuel is unusable, it's not because there's no more uranium left in the fuel. It's actually mostly uranium still. It's mostly the kind of uranium that doesn't readily fission in current reactors, which is uranium-238. There's a little bit of uranium-235, a lot less than it started with, 0.2 or 0.3%, about the same amount of plutonium, and a sprinkling of fission products. And the fission products are sucking up these neutrons, these subatomic particles, and they're shutting down the chain reaction. And so the reactor, or the fuel bundle, is actually past its prime in the reactor, and it gets pulled out. Now, the reason you can reuse it, you can either go in and extract that remaining uranium and plutonium, or even better, you can go after that other more than 99% of it, which is uranium-238, and you can put that into a different type of reactor called a fast breeder reactor, and you can create fuel out of that. And you can go through this cycle several times and eventually use up most of that uranium. And by the way, also destroy most of the long-lived radioisotopes in the fuel so that it's not a long-lived waste management problem.
So when you've taken, like...
Caller, that's all the time we have for you. Thanks very much.
Thank you for the question.
So we're going to go to another commercial, and we'll be right back. Next time on Skeptically Speaking, we'll be talking about biotechnology ethics with author, philosopher, and ethicist Chris McDonald. And there's a lot of ethical ground to cover. Genetically modified crops that allow us to feed more people than ever before, the Terminator genes that make the second generation of seeds sterile. Personal genetic testing companies that will tell you if you're predisposed to certain illnesses, but will also tell you whether your little princess has a future in sports. And did you know 20% of your genes are patented? Yes, your genes. Find out more on the next Skeptically Speaking, 6 p.m. Mountain Daylight Time, here on CJSR.
Welcome back. Question for Elena. The cause report mentions that when the entire nuclear cycle is considered, nuclear power contributes more to global warming than alternatives such as wind power. Explain that to us.
Even though there's no emission of CO2 during the operation of a nuclear reactor, when you look at the full cycle, including the uranium mining, the construction, the decommissioning, the waste storage, the refining, it actually, various peer-reviewed studies have shown that it actually is responsible for 60 to up to 120 CO2 emissions per per kilowatt hour. And that's actually 3 to 10 times as much as wind. The recent report by the nuclear panel suggested it was the same then. That is not correct. And in fact, if you take the 4,000 megawatts that they plan to develop in the Peace River region, that actually averages out to about 3 million tons of CO2 a year. The Kyoto Agreement did not see nuclear as a solution to global warming. So that's certainly what the nuclear industry talks about, is the big reason to go nuclear, despite the cost, despite the risks, but it's not the solution for that either.
Now, before you respond, Jeremy, again, callers, I think we have time for maybe one more call, if you're lucky. 780-492-2577, extension 1, or live at skepticallyspeaking.com, or Skeptical Weight Radio on Twitter. Go ahead, Jeremy.
Yeah, most of the studies out there have done that have looked at the CO2 contribution have concluded that it's in the same range as wind. It depends on where you get your fuel from, obviously, because there's a huge energy component in enriching the fuel. So it depends on which part of the world actually your study comes from. Electrical energy, because these enrichment plants use electricity. If in fact you use electricity to run the enrichment plants that comes from nuclear power, then you wipe that out. There's no CO2, but they're currently run by coal plants. So it's in the same range. But whether it's 2 or 3 times more, it doesn't matter. It's still you know, thousands of times less than coal, which is what it's all about. It's all about replacing. So we're quibbling over who's the noblest here, and I put forth that we're all in the same basket. We're all an answer to global warming, if you believe in global warming.
But again, the choice is not nuclear or coal. That's what is always put forward. We don't want coal, so we take nuclear. But again, the ability is there to go to energy efficiency and to renewable energy instead.
True, but not wind power or solar, because you need baseload reliable power.
Yeah, I think we've gone with that one. Yes. I think it can be achieved. And I encourage the listeners to go to www.nuclearfreealberta.ca, which is our website, and it'll link you to the Pembina Institute Screening the Grid, as well as other reports.
Can I just ask, if you're against nuclear in Alberta, are you against nuclear medicine use in nuclear hospitals?
Actually, I understand that there's now, with the problems that there have been at Chalk River, they're now looking at producing isotopes from non-nuclear sources. I don't know the technical details, but that's what I've heard. So I think there are better ways to produce isotopes.
I don't mean where they come from. They are themselves radioactive. Are you against the use of radioactive tracers?
I'm even medically for use when needed. I personally, for example, won't have regular X-rays, either dental or for other reasons. But when there's a suspicion of something, when there's a need, I don't think radiation should be used routinely. I'm sure you're aware of the BIR-7 reports that are put out by the U.S. National Academy of Science that has concluded over and over again by studying the victims of Hiroshima that there is no low threshold of exposure to radiation, that any exposure at any level has health impacts.
Yeah, that's just an assumption for safety reasons, though. There's no observable effect below 10 rem, which is thousands of times greater than background. We have not seen any effect. Good or bad, there's no effect of it. In fact, there is some evidence that suggests the levels of radiation are actually good for the human system.
That's actually been disproved recently by the National Academies. Again, this is the organization.
No,
it's been disproved. It's the organization that the United States government relies on for their scientific advice.
No, Elena, your information's not complete.
Yours certainly doesn't seem to be.
You can both send me links, and I will post them all. All right. I know we have an email.
Yeah, we sure do. I'm going to just swing the microphone over here. We're a little crowded in the station here today.
You guys could see the size of this studio.
It's a party.
Yes. Okay. So I got another somewhat lengthy email here. It basically starts from greenpeace.ca on the end the nuclear threat page. It's kind of a true or false question for the panel here. And the 6 points are dirty, dangerous, expensive, unreliable, too slow, and undermines a clean energy future. And we've already talked about a few of these points. So I don't know if we've really delved into two of them that kind of go together, expensive and unreliable. And I'll just quickly read those here. Every nuclear plant in Canada has undergone massive cost overruns and delays. The high cost of nuclear power effectively bankrupted the Ontario Hydro. Ontario Power Generation recently admitted that long-term management of radioactive waste would cost $18 billion. And for the unreliable half, while Ontario's reactors were designed to operate for 40 years, Ontario Power Generation admitted in 2003 that they would need to shut down or be rebuilt at a high cost and risk after only 25 years.
Jeremy?
Yeah, this is often brought forward. When we're talking about building a reactor in Alberta, we are not talking about the reactor building program of which we had, the type we had in the rest of Canada, which was government-driven, built and owned by governments. The biggest, the poster boy for nuclear cost increases is the Darlington plant east of Toronto, and the cost increases there are largely caused by government interference. And it's because Ontario Hydro is an extension of government policy for all three parties, which took their chance at being in the government of Ontario at the time. And so they all came into power. They all put moratoriums on the finishing the construction of Darlington. And the thing is, no one has billions of dollars, right? Everyone borrows money if they need billions of dollars. So nobody has cash. Even governments to build nuclear reactors, it's always borrowed, and you don't start paying down that principal until you start supplying the benefit to the ratepayer. This is the law, and so the longer you delay the construction until the day you turn the thing on, the higher the interest goes. So all of those increases are through interest. So what do you do about this? Well, you have to have more control over the building of the reactor. You can't have governments coming in and saying they're going to have a 2-year moratorium while the thing sits there. An example of doing that is when AECL built its latest two CANDU-6 reactors on the other side of the planet in China, at Tsingshan, China, which came in under schedule and below schedule and on budget. And we actually set construction records for doing that. If we can do that on the other side of the planet, we can do that in Alberta.
Go ahead, Ellen.
Okay, for first of all, in terms of exporting CANDUs, I want to read a Maclean's magazine quote because it sums it all up. It's Maclean said, if we have to loan people money at subsidized interest rates to buy CANDUs at prices below cost and then bribe them to do it, because at one point there was a charge of bribing, how great is the accomplishment? So that's on the exporting. But I want to go, in terms of the cost, these 4,000 megawatt reactors that are being proposed here by Bruce Power in Alberta are being priced at variously 10 to 12 billion. I've seen both numbers. But if you look at what's happening with third generation reactors elsewhere, Moody's Investors has priced 1,000 megawatts at 7,500 billion US. So that puts the estimate at somewhere around 30, 35 billion. It's gone down a bit with the Canadian dollar going up. But at any rate, it's three times what's being estimated by Bruce Power. And AECL has, with its partners, Team CANDU, that includes SNC-Lavalin, have already written and gone to the federal government and asked them if they'll cover the cost overruns. So the people that are paying for nuclear here in Canada are the taxpayers. That's who's going to be paying for them. In Ontario, similarly, they've been looking at AECL as maybe the preferred for a build there. And again, it depends on someone, the taxpayers, covering the cost overruns. As well, CANDUs have been subsidized by the taxpayer an average from 1952 to 2002, that's 50 years, about $17.5 billion. And even currently, it's the current funding is $350 billion without even counting supplements for Chalk River and some refurbishment of pressure tubes.
Now, this could be, honestly, three times the length, this interview. But I think we're pretty much out of time for today. I'm going to ask Jeremy, first of all, is there any last words that you'd like to say about this issue?
Well, just very quickly on cost, there has been an R&D investment. What you're talking about, the $17 billion it's actually close to $30 billion now in modern-day dollars. In actual dollars, it's about $6 billion that the taxpayers provided to Chalk River Laboratories. And CANDU reactors make that back, honestly, on an annual basis in terms of electricity produced and benefit to the gross domestic product. In terms of the loans, these have all been done on the typical Export Development Agency loans, and they're all paid back or being paid back. There's absolutely no issue there. I think it's the only viable large-scale baseload power source that can go into a mix, which does include renewable sources like wind.
I invite you all to continue this conversation on www.skepticallyspeaking.com. And I believe Sean has a message for us all.
Yeah, I just wanted to give everyone a reminder that we have our on-topic event. That's our new speaker series with the Center for Inquiry and a mix of other groups. That will be Monday night, 7:30 p.m. at the Accent Lounge, just off White Avenue and Calgary Trail. And that'll be every second Monday here on in.
And I'd like to say thank you so much to our guests for being in the studio today. This is a really important issue that no one besides nuclear physicists and the people that are opposing them know much about, really. So thanks very much to Jeremy and to Elena for being part of the show.
Thank you very much for having me on.
A pleasure, Desiree. Thank you. Thank you, Sean.
Thanks for the great discussion, everyone.
Good night, everyone.
South America doesn't exist. The moon is painted on the sky. Things sometimes fall up, but you never see. And everything you believe is a lie.
Dinosaurs were invented by God as a test. Our bodies don't rot when we die. The hippies are working for the gods.